pleasure to introduce Brian Dolan, who's visiting us from Edinburgh. He's going to be here for a couple of months on sabbatical. Brian is has been here, well, many of us know him because he's visited here before several times. He is a field theorist by training, has done lots of interesting work on quantum field theory, mathematical physics, and black hole physics. But he usually hangs out mostly with cosmologists, so that's why we made him an honorary cosmologist.
Thank you.
And you're welcome. Because, yeah, he's too cool to hang out with other groups like this. And I'm the coolest group, and GI. So he's going to tell us about black holes and boys out today.
Thanks, Naish. When Marina asked if I could give a talk, I hastily put together a title, and I think the title that went round on the email list was Einstein's Greatest Mistake. And I realized that usually the quotation is Einstein's greatest blunder, the cosmological constant. I think it was a conversation with Gamow when Einstein said that introducing the cosmological constant was his greatest blunder. And what I'm going to talk about today is how you can use the cosmological constant, or a possible way of using the cosmological constant in black hole thermodynamics. Now, does this work? Not with my machine, okay. I actually gave a talk on these ideas a couple of years ago, the last time I was here, but there's been a lot of progress since then. But I won't assume that people are familiar with the ideas here. I'm going to start with a review of black hole thermodynamics, which is very elementary, and I apologize to the experts for whom they'll all be well known. But I'm assuming that not everyone in the audience might be familiar with black hole thermodynamics. This is a cosmology seminar, and you might think that talking about the cosmological constant would be very important, very apt for a cosmology seminar, but actually I'm going to say, I'm a bit embarrassed about this because I'll be saying nothing about cosmology. This is all very theoretical stuff. It's conceptual about the thermodynamics of black holes. As far as I'm aware, it has absolutely no applications whatsoever to date to anything in cosmology or astrophysics. But I hope, I may be wrong.
Is that a challenge?
Yeah, I'm throwing that out as a challenge. I think the ideas here, I hope to convince you in the next 50 minutes that these ideas are very interesting and are telling us a lot about the physics of black holes and quantum field theory. So then I'll go on to discuss entropy and volume in black holes and do some, and then the equation of state. I'll talk about the thermodynamic stability. Most of what I'm going to be talking about, as I say, it's not going to be relevant to cosmology because I'm going to be using lambda negative for most of this talk. I'll be talking about asymptotically anti-de Sitter black holes mostly. If I have time at the end, I'll say a little bit about them asymptotically de Sitter. But we'll see how time goes. Okay, so a little bit about the basics of black hole thermodynamics. We know that one of the things about black holes is they have an event horizon. And for a Schwarzschild black hole, the event horizon sits at twice the Schwarzschild mass. So the area, of course, trivially. Yeah? I don't know the answer to that.
Yes,
but I hope Naish does.
Yes.
Oh, don't worry about the
this Yeah.
Is it going a little bit darker?
Turn off everything.
Turn off everything.
But not the computer, please.
That's much better.
Is that okay? Is that okay? Right. Okay. The surface gravity of a Schwarzschild black hole, so the surface gravity is just acceleration due to gravity for an observer. Relative to infinity. So at the surface of the Earth, it's 10 meters per second squared. For Schwarzschild black hole, it works out as 1 over 4gm. This is actually, you get this just by using m over r squared. It's one of these coincidences in GR where the naive non-Newtonian result actually gives you the correct relativistic answer. But you can't use a naive Newtonian result for more sophisticated situations, for Kerr black holes, for example. It's only for Schwarzschild that the Newtonian result gives you the correct answer, that the surface gravity is inversely proportional to the mass. And when you first hear about black holes, you think of these voracious objects, these massive objects that just suck in everything and nothing can come out. And you tend to form this picture that the thing will get more, as time goes on, it absorbs more and more mass, gets bigger and bigger, the mass gets bigger and bigger, it'll get more and more bloated. But it was realized early on that the situation is a bit more subtle than that. It is possible for the mass to decrease. If you have a rotating black hole, for example, Penrose showed that you can extract energy from a rotating black hole by essentially a slingshot type of idea, that you throw something in and it comes out faster than it went in, and you absorb the angular momentum of the black hole goes down. And the mass can actually go down. But it was noticed that something never goes down. It was originally called, I think, Cristodulo-Ruffini reducible mass. And eventually it got realized that it was really the area of the black hole was the thing that never goes down. So this led Bekenstein to suggest that perhaps the area should be thought of as an entropy. Then this is consistent with the idea that nothing can come out of the black hole. So if you throw your computer hard drive into the black hole, for example, if there's lots of information on your hard drive, once it's gone through the event horizon, it's gone. You've lost it. So information can go into the black hole but can never come out. So this led Bekenstein to suggest that the area of the black hole should be identified with entropy. And in units where Boltzmann's constant is unity, the entropy is dimensionless. So Bekenstein suggested it was you divide the area by the square of the Planck length to get a dimensionless quantity. And then a few years later, Hawking. If the entropy is non-zero, then you would think there should be a non-zero temperature. And a few years later, Hawking calculated the temperature, and he showed that the temperature is proportional to surface gravity. And I'm using here, I'm going to use, later on, I'll use units where Newton's constant is one. But I'll keep it, I'll try and keep Planck's constant explicit in all the formula, because when you're not familiar with this, it can be very confusing as to whether you're converting length to masses using Newton's constant to get the Schwarzschild mass relative to the Schwarzschild radius, or whether you're using Planck's constant to get the Compton length associated with the Compton mass, with the mass. And it can be very confusing. So I'm going to try and keep H bar explicit to make it absolutely clear what's quantum. And we see from here that the Hawking temperature is fundamentally a quantum phenomenon. It's not quantum gravity. It's sourcing classical gravity with a quantum field. And the entropy, you notice, as H bar goes to zero, the entropy diverges, which is a common phenomenon in statistical physics. OK, so this is the famous Hawking temperature, inversely proportional to the mass. And as I said, there won't be much in this seminar that's relevant to astrophysics, because if you work this out for a solar mass black hole, it's about 10 to minus 8 Kelvin. So completely irrelevant in any astrophysical context. But as the mass goes down, the temperature goes up. 10 to minus 8 Kelvin is a temperature that was probably never realized in the entire universe until a couple of decades ago when people got to nano-Kelvin in the laboratory. Before cryogenic experiments in laboratories, probably there was nowhere in the universe that had a temperature less than 2.7 Kelvin, unless there's some intelligent civilization out there that got to superconductivity before we did. OK, so let me summarize the laws of black hole thermodynamics. The zeroth law of thermodynamics essentially is a definition of temperature. Well, not quite a definition, but it's saying that there exists a quantity called temperature, which in equilibrium, the temperature is the same at all places in the body. If we're going to identify temperature with surface gravity, then the zeroth law of black hole thermodynamics says the surface gravity is the same at every point in the event horizon. So that's what's usually called the zeroth law. In thermodynamics, the internal energy of the thermodynamic system should be a function of entropy, and the temperature is derivative of the internal energy. In gravity, it's natural to identify mass with energy. So if we identify the internal energy with the mass, then differentiate that, we get the first law in the form that du is TdS. We can generalize that to include angular momentum and charge on the black hole. J is angular momentum, charge is Q, so omega is angular velocity. Finds electrostatic potential, then we get the first law of black hole thermodynamics in this form. Now, with Hawking's identification of the temperature as being 1 over 8 pi m, since the entropy is proportional to the area, which is proportional to 6 pi m squared, you put this form of the entropy and this form of the temperature into this equation here, you can derive the the coefficient, that the entropy is a quarter the area over h bar. This is Hawking's famous formula. So if the area of the event horizon is an entropy, then the second law of thermodynamics would translate in black hole terminology to saying that the area of a black hole can never decrease. And I've put a qualifier here, classically, because it's, I'm sure as many, if not all of you know that when you, because of this H bar in Hawking's temperature here, there are quantum corrections to this statement. It's interesting to work out the entropy of an astrophysical object like the sun, or not the sun, but an astrophysical black hole with the mass of the sun. For a black hole with the mass of a solar mass, it works out as about 10 to 78, which is a very large number by anyone's standards. So let's think about the third law. Nernst's statements of the third law of thermodynamics says you can never reach zero temperature in a finite number of steps.
Can I just ask a question? Can you prove this in a black hole independent way? So I mean, everything you've done so far is using results from Schwarzschild black hole.
Yes.
Is it possible to just use general relativity and say general relativity holds these the black hole, or these are the laws of black hole, and to object on a black hole by black hole basis?
Well, I don't think you can prove these from general relativity, but.
The first.
Yeah, sure, but not all of them.
Well, the second one can prove. You don't need Einstein's equations.
Yeah, that's like 0 through 2.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think you can prove all of them in classical GR. But it's certainly the case that, the second law here, the area never decreases. This, as I said, really, this relates to the Christodoulou-Ruffini mass formula. This was an observation from many solutions of Einstein's equations from which this was extracted.
But didn't Hawking prove that area?
But that was a culmination of these ideas.
Okay.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So the third law, translated into black hole terminology, says that you can never achieve zero surface gravity in a finite number of steps for a black hole. Now, this is there's a slight tension here with another statement of the third law, which says that the ground state of a system at zero temperature should have zero entropy. But I've already said that the entropy of a solar mass black hole is of the order of 10 to 78. For a Kerr black hole, the surface gravity goes to zero when a Kerr black hole becomes extremal. That's when the angular momentum becomes so large that the system becomes unstable. And that happens when J squared is m to the fourth. That can happen. There's no reason for, that can't happen for solar mass black holes. We believe there could be black holes out there which are close to extremal with a solar mass. And these black holes can have zero surface gravity, but the entropy is 10 to the power 4, or basically 10 to the power 10 to the 78. So there's a slight tension there between the two statements of the third law. There's not a contradiction in the statement that these two statements of the third law, the statement that the entropy should be zero, the entropy of the ground state should be zero, assumes the ground state's non-degenerate. Right? When Nernst stated the third law that you can only reach zero entropy, you cannot reach zero entropy in a finite number of states, he assumed the ground state was non-degenerate. Now, he wasn't an idiot. That's a very natural assumption to make, the ground state is non-degenerate. Because nature tends to abhor degenerate vacua. You introduce a perturbation, you tend to lift the degeneracy. A system that has a degenerate vacuum, there must be some symmetry that protects the vacuum from becoming non-degenerate. This could be some sort of hint in quantum gravity that there should be some really powerful symmetry that protects your ground state from lifting this massive degeneracy. That's the message I get from that.
Is that like one of his CFDs? Do you think is that the current
thinking? That depends who you are. I'm going to say nothing about microscopic physics. I'm going to try and avoid any statement about microscopic physics. There are many theories in the market. I'm sure many of you have heard of the Strominger-Wafer calculation of entropy of a black hole using supergravity. That requires making some kind of assumption about the microscopic physics, which I'm going to try and avoid doing. Okay. The temperature is inverse proportional to the mass for a Schwarzschild black hole. Well, if it's going on zero temperature, it's radiating So I'm sure you all know that Schwarzschild black holes are unstable, because this formula is saying that as the mass goes down, the temperature goes up, so it will radiate even more. So we have a runaway effect, it's unstable. The heat capacity is negative. We can work out, estimate the lifetime. It will radiate with a power, which is given by the Stefan-Boltzmann law. It's the area times the fourth power of the temperature. And I've put in the powers of h bar here and the Stefan-Boltzmann constant just to try and make the quantum mechanics explicit. The area goes like the square of the mass. The temperature goes like 1 over mass to the fourth. So the power goes like the inverse square of the mass. And notice the h bar upstairs. This is a quantum effect. So you can estimate the lifetime just by saying we'll take the mass and divide it by the power. That will give you a rough idea of the lifetime, assuming this process continues. Lifetime is going to be proportional to the third power of the mass. Classically, the lifetime is infinite. So for a solar mass black hole, again, this is many, many orders of magnitude greater than the lifetime of the universe. It's not relevant. But if we had a black hole of the order of something like 10 to 12 kilograms, its lifetime works out as about the age of the universe. So this led Hawking to suggest that if mini black holes had been created in the early universe, notice the power goes like the inverse square of the mass. So as the mass goes down, the power gets greater and greater and greater. So this leads to the concept of an exploding black hole when the mass is very small. So Hawking suggested if there were many black holes created in the early universe with mass of the order of 10 to 12 kilograms, they should be exploding today. No one has ever seen one. So. However, this raises a question. If the black hole is shrinking, then when you write down this as heat capacity, are we talking about heat capacity at constant volume or heat capacity at constant pressure? Which is it?
Can I just ask one question? Why would they be exploding today? Are they not radiating steadily over the lifetime of the universe?
Yes, but the amount it radiates increases as the mass goes down.
Oh, I see.
And it, towards the end, when the mass is very small, the power is huge.
So you're actually losing that.
So most of the power goes out, or well, a lot of the. If this happened, you'd see it as some burst of very high energy radiation at the end of the.
So they're not radiating fixed mass, they're actually radiating their mass.
Yes, 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 yes. The mass decreases as they lose energy. Yeah, energy is conserved. Okay, so is the heat capacity at constant volume or constant pressure? Well, let's rethink the first law. When you learn thermodynamics as a first year student, this is usually the way the first law is written. So this suggests, including a pressure in black hole thermodynamics, and there's a very natural candidate for pressure in general relativity, it's a cosmological constant. So let's include a cosmological constant. This will contribute a pressure. The energy density equation state of the cosmological constant is that the energy density is minus the pressure. So now let's look. The thermal energy, U, is now, it's not going to be just the mass of the black hole, the energy in the mass of the black hole, but there's also the energy density in the vacuum times the volume of the black hole. That should be the total energy. But the energy density at silent is minus the pressure. So the internal energy is M minus PV. M is U plus PV. Now, when you have a volume in thermodynamics, the internal energy is a function of entropy and volume. So this is a Legendre transform. The mass is not the internal energy. It's the enthalpy. It's what chemists call the enthalpy of the thermodynamic system.
Sorry, I'm confused. So, this transparency, you didn't need any at all, because most of the constant, you could have one variable, the specific heat anyway. So why, I mean, they don't have to think about a cosmological constant. It's needed to respond to this question, because the question would be there regardless.
Yes. This does not resolve the negative specific heat.
Okay.
I'm going to say more about that later. We have to look at the full local thermodynamic stability, but what I'm going to argue is that when you look at the thermodynamic, the local stability, you should include the pressure and the volume to get a. It doesn't. There are still the Schwarzschild black hole still has negative specific heat. It doesn't resolve that. The notion that the cosmological constant should be included should be a variable goes back a long way. The first paper I'm aware of is Henno and Teitelbaum. But the idea that the mass should be the enthalpy rather than internal energy was first proposed by Cassori and Trashin in 2009. So, if the mass is the enthalpy, now for most of the rest of this talk, I'm going to restrict to the case of positive pressure because that's the easiest case to consider. So we'll take lambda to be negative. In thermodynamics, the volume is the derivative of the enthalpy with respect to pressure at constant entropy. So I'm going to define the volume of the black hole using this equation. And I call this a thermodynamic volume because I want to stress there is no reason why this should have anything to do with the geometric volume. In fact, it's difficult to define the geometric volume of a black hole. For a Schwarzschild black hole inside the event horizon, the radial coordinate is time-like. If you take a space-like section of the metric inside the Schwarzschild, inside the horizon, you get a time-dependent metric with an infinite volume. The Schwarzschild black hole is only static outside of the event horizon. Inside of the event horizon, it's not a static metric. So I call it, and often I'll call this the volume, but I want you to bear in mind it's a thermodynamic volume. It is not a priori, doesn't have any relation to a geometric volume. Nevertheless, if you work it out for the Schwarzschild metric, this is what you get. It looks like the volume of a sphere in Euclidean space with radius RH. But I'd like to stress this is not any geometric volume of a black hole. You can do it in higher dimensions. Again, it's the for a Schwarzschild black hole, it works out as the volume of a ball in Euclidean space. You can work it out for rotating black holes in higher dimensions, which are asymptotically ADS. This was done by Gary Gibbons and David a while ago. I won't write down the general expression. For a charged Kerr, you can give them the black hole a charge as well. And what I want to mention here is that for charged Kerr, as the angular momentum goes to zero, the volume goes like 4 pi over 3 RH squared. But of course, the entropy is a quarter of the area, so the entropy is going like pi R squared. So the volume and the entropy are not independent. When the black hole rotates, they become independent. But when the angular momentum is zero, the volume and the entropy are not independent. And that has some interesting consequences, which I'll mention in a minute. Just to give you, you can write down an equation of state. This is an equation of state for the Schwarzschild black hole.
So question. Mm-hmm. Why do you look at positive pressures? So what's the problem with
negative? Oh, well, in asymptotically de Sitter, well, first of all, there's two event horizons. There's a black hole event horizon and there's a cosmological event horizon, so there's two temperatures. Right. So it doesn't look as though it's in thermodynamic equilibrium. So there's subtleties there. And also, for asymptotically anti-de Sitter, the mass that I'm talking about is the ADM mass. And there's no ADM mass in de Sitter because.
Sorry, ADM mass isn't defined.
Well, there's a version of it that when you go to asymptotically, you can use the isometries, the time-like isometries of anti de Sitter to define the mass by going to R going to infinity. That's what I'm calling that an ADM mass. Maybe you don't want to call it that.
Yeah.
But.
So you really mean that was Hindo
title? Sorry?
Hindo
It's very likely they were the first people to do it. Yeah, I think that's right. They were the first people to do it. Yeah, you can't do that in de Sitter.
And what we, is that really what? Because I would have said I can derive a first law equation from GR using that definition of mass. I will not get the second term.
Well, it depends what definition of mass you use.
I
mean, there's no local definition of mass. Okay, I haven't thought too much about other definitions of mass.
Okay.
That's an important issue. I relate that to the statement that the definition of mass in general relativity is, in some situations, it's debatable.
But you're saying that there's a different mass that you get from.
Well, no, I would say in all the definitions of mass, which I don't have to make any sense, you will not get such a term. As a term, I think you must be doing something different, and I have no idea what that can be.
Okay, well,
you're making the asymptotics time dependent.
Right.
Or you're changing volume somehow in some way that I don't understand this picture.
The asymptotics are time independent, yes.
But
and you can do that in anti de Sitter space.
No, but to have a VDP term, you need, pressure is, because Majorana constant is constant.
Oh yeah, you change, yes. As you vary the cosmological constant, you vary the boundary conditions at infinity. Yes, that's true.
Yes, you're doing one of the things that within tradition VR are not kosher. So you're doing something weird.
Yeah.
Well, we had an inflation.
We heard this. Four form that gives you a variable cosmological.
Hennu and Teitelbaum, that when they first considered varying the cosmological constant came as a parameter in the solution. There are models where the cosmological constant parameter solution is a parameter in the solution. We heard a seminar from Andrew Liddle last week, which gave very strong evidence the cosmological constant was different in the past to what it is today.
But if you're doing time-dependent asymptotics, and I have no idea what you're talking about.
I wouldn't say that asymptotics are time-dependent, no.
If you're varying lambda, I don't think.
If you want to think of lambda as a function of time, then yes, the asymptotics become. But this is thermodynamics, so we think of adiabatic changes.
Can you just go back a little bit? I'm losing the rationale because the horizon law itself has a thermodynamic description.
Mm-hmm. I want the thermodynamic description to apply to the whole space-time.
To the whole of space-time, not just around the horizon.
So you use Euclidean action. The thermodynamics is determined by the Euclidean action. The thermodynamics is determined by the Euclidean action. That's one way of getting all these thermodynamic relations, is to work out the Euclidean action for your solution. The Euclidean action is associated with the whole space-time, not just... Well, it's a static, if you're dealing with stationary solutions, then you can discuss the action, the Euclidean action for the whole space-time, and that gives you the thermodynamics. The event horizon is necessary for the Hawking temperature. So you want a space-time that includes an event horizon. But you can discuss the thermodynamics on the basis of the whole space-time.
But then what is temperature?
It's the Hawking temperature of the black hole.
But that's only too close to the horizon.
But that doesn't have a local definition. The Hawking temperature requires, you need to know, the Hawking temperature is determined by the difference between an inertial observer at infinity and an inertial observer at the event horizon. There is no local definition of Hawking temperature. It's associated with the whole space-time, not just the event horizon.
But yeah, I feel like I'm very far from the, I can use the same temperature everywhere.
It's only defined relative to asymptotic to infinity, so. You need the whole space-time. Okay. So this is the equation of state for the Schwarzschild-Metic in four dimensions. And this is a PV diagram. These are the red lines are constant temperature. With pressure against volume. The observation that when the black hole is not rotating, the entropy and the volume are not independent. Led Clifford Johnson to look at Carnot cycles in the PV plane. And an adiabat, a line of constant entropy, is the same as a line of constant volume. So a Carnot cycle looks like this, which is interesting consequences because we know that the usual law for an adiabatic line in the PV diagram is that PV to the gamma is a constant. So we write that as P to the 1 over gamma times V is a constant. These vertical lines here mean that gamma is infinite when the black hole is non-rotating. So the equation state is looking like that of a gas of molecules, where each molecule has an infinite number of internal degrees of freedom, all of which can be excited thermally. Remember, gamma is usually related to the number of internal degrees in your molecule that can be excited. It's lowest for a monatomic gas, and then it becomes greater for diatomic and so on. So it's kind of looking.
Can you also tell something about the density as well?
I don't have a mass of molecules. So.
Yeah,
you can use a thermodynamic volume to define a thermodynamic density, which is just the mass divided by the volume. But I mean, there's no molecular interpretation of that.
So this is applying for J equals zero?
This is only J equals zero.
But if it's not zero, then gamma is not constant.
Well, if it's not zero, you don't have such a simple equation. If it's not zero, what happens is, see these lines here are going through, the pressure goes through zero at zero volume. When you make it rotate, this is what happens. A rotation repulses these lines away from P is equal to zero. So this is a PV diagram for a four-dimensional black hole, lines of constant temperature. And I'm using the angular momentum here to make the pressure and the volume dimensionless. So this is dimensionless volume and dimensionless pressure. And we notice that, so increasing temperatures going upward in the diagram here. So this isotherm here is monotonically decreasing, whereas this isotherm here goes to a minimum and comes up. And there's a critical value of the temperature, at which case, where you have an inflection point. And there's a critical point here. This is behaving very, and you look at the universality class of the critical point, it has mean field exponents. It's behaving like a van der Waals gas. The equation of state near the critical point, the equation of state is the same analytic form as a van der Waals gas. The existence of this critical point for rotating black holes was first found by Caldarelli, Cagnola, and Clem, and the analysis in terms of van der Waals gases and mean field exponents and things was first done by David and Rob. You can plot this in the in phase space in the pressure temperature plane. So, this the perimeter hockey stick. Yeah, thank you. So we have temperature along the horizontal axis here and pressure along the vertical axis. And this phase transition is like a phase transition between small black holes and large black holes. We have a line of first order phase transitions terminating in a critical point. So it's exactly the same phase diagram as for a van der Waals gas. There's a latent heat. If you cross this line at any point, the latent heat is the temperature times the change in entropy. And that's just the difference between the mass of the large black hole and the mass of the small black hole. The slope of this line, you can prove, is given by the usual Clapeyron equation. That along this line, the slope is given by the ratio of the jump in entropy to the jump in volume as you go from one phase to another. Interesting things happen in higher dimensions. In six dimensions, there are two angular momenta, because in six space-time dimensions, a black hole would have a four-dimensional event horizon. So for a four-dimensional sphere, of course, SO5 has rank 2, so there are two angular momenta. And the phase diagram depends on the ratio of these two angular momenta. So this diagram is taken from another paper by David and Rob, which shows the, again, this is the pressure temperature plane. And we see that there are now three black holes, the small, intermediate, and large. So there are two, there's a first order transition line here, a first order transition line here, both of which end in critical points. And there's a triple point. So, there are quite complicated phase diagrams are showing very interesting phenomena. There are other things that are examples of re-entrant phase transitions where you have three phases and two phases A and B, and by varying a single thermodynamic parameter, you can go from A to B and back into A again. That's called the re-entrant phase transitions. They're well studied in condensed matter, and they exist in black hole physics as well.
All of this, you're just using the GR equations for equilibrium, basically, black holes in a
yes.
space.
Yes.
So you can just do the same thing for the Sitterius space, right? I mean, you don't have to worry about
one that. Could, but then I would worry about it. Well, I would worry about the fact that there are two temperatures.
But I mean, these are all like in some sort of formal substitution. So at GR, I mean, classically nothing happens, right? So.
Shouldn't it automatically tell you what the temperature should be in those
cases? No, it doesn't actually. Well, if I have time, I have a slide on the sitter at the end. Can we leave the sitter to the end? I hope I have time
you're
to.
Going to have with the okay.
Yeah, I'm going to mention. I was going to mention the sitter right at the end.
I was just
going to
ask whether there are similar phase conditions.
Oh, I'm not aware of any.
Okay.
But
have you looked?
I haven't looked. The de Sitter case, I think it's safe to say the Sitter case has not been analyzed to the same extent as the anti-de Sitter case. Okay. Now let's go back to this negative heat capacity. I want to look at the local thermodynamic stability. In ordinary thermodynamics, the entropy is a function of extensive variables. It'd be a function of the internal energy, the volume, and for a single component gas, the number of.
So what's the difference with having a negative heat capacity means there's an instability.
Yes.
Having
yes.
two temperatures also means there's an instability. Right? So in
sense, a normal system, yes.
So I mean, these two are seems that they're on the same footing, right?
Yeah, yeah. But an instability is not necessarily a disaster. I mean,
sure,
no, you can put an ice cube into a glass of water at room temperature and watch it melt.
Right.
The ice cube is unstable, but you can still describe the process using thermodynamics. And
right.
It's a question of time scales.
Two horizon case there.
Possibly.
As it happens slowly, which is
maybe the heat exchange between the two horizons, and you'd evolve towards a situation where both horizons are the same temperature.
The North Pole is colder than the equator, but we're all still.
Yes, indeed.
For the moment. For the moment.
And then we're all okay.
That's a problem. Okay. So in thermodynamics, the entropy is a function of extensive variables. And local stability requires that the entropy be a concave function of all the variables. So mathematically, that says if we work out the second derivative of the entropy, then the Hessian should be a negative matrix, or minus that derivative should be a positive matrix. Another description of thermodynamics is to invert this fundamental relation and write the internal energy as a function of entropy volume and N. And the statement the entropy is concave translates to the statement that the internal energy should be convex. Now, the intensive variables are the Lagrange transforms of the extensive variables. I'm not sure if is that clear. This is meant to be a small x, and that's a capital X. I hope that's it's maybe not quite clear. And if we scale, so extensive variables all scale like d. If d here in d space dimensions, then all the entropy volume and the number of particles all scale like the dimension of space. And the internal energy is also extensive. If you differentiate this equation with respect to lambda and set lambda equal to 1, you derive this relation here. This is related to what's famously called the Gibbs-Duhem relation in thermodynamics. If we take the complete Lagrange transform of U and turn everything into intensive variables, temperature, pressure, and chemical potential, then the complete Lagrange, this equation here tells us that the complete Lagrange transform actually vanishes. In ordinary thermodynamics. In ordinary thermodynamics, no one ever completely Lagrange transforms on everything. Because if you did, you get zero. In black hole thermodynamics, what happens? Well, the first question you have to ask is, what's an extensive variable? It's not obvious. Right. If we look at a table of the dimensions of the various quantities for a black hole, using Newton's constant to work out to turn lengths into masses. So these are all mass dimensions. So in four dimensions, M is dimension one. That comes from the dimensions of Newton. This is just dimensional counting. So if you look at this table, I'm going to propose that an extensive parameter is one that depends on the dimension of space-time. This is rather different to the thermodynamic definition of an extensive parameter, but for black hole physics, I think this makes sense. It's important to distinguish extensive and intensive, and I had an exchange with a referee on this point who didn't like what I was doing because these things are, the mass of a black hole is not extensive in the same sense that extensive parameters, you have extensive parameters in thermodynamics. But if you use this as a working definition of an extensive, then we can look at scaling of the internal energy, including electric charge and angular momentum, then these are the dimensions here. And notice things are scaling differently. And this can be an important point because in rigorous formulations of thermodynamics, there are rigorous formulations of thermodynamics. This homogeneous scaling that thermodynamics have, where all the extensive parameters scale by the same amount, is actually considered to be very important in thermodynamics. And there are even formulations of thermodynamics where it's an axiom that everything scales the same way. All extensive parameters scale the same way. And that doesn't happen in black holes. Right? So in black holes, you have this inhomogeneous scaling. But I think that actually opens an interesting question in thermodynamics. When is inhomogeneous scaling consistent with a logical thermodynamic system? And as far as I can tell, that's not been investigated. But anyway, let's assume it works. You do the same thing. You differentiate this equation with respect to lambda and set lambda equal to 1. And you get what's called the SMAR relation, except SMAR didn't include pressure and volume, but pressure and volume was included by Cassorey and Trashin. And you get this relation here where these numbers, ds, dv, and so on, are given by these ratios of the dimension of space-time. Now, if you work out the complete Legendre transform, it's non-zero. This is what you get. And this is important in relativity, because the complete Legendre transform is actually the Euclidean action. When you work out the Euclidean action for these things, apart from this factor of temperature, this is actually what you're calculating. It's the complete Legendre transform of the internal energy. Yeah. Yes,
right?
Yes, so yes.
You can collect many of them and then everything scales.
Yes,
out of the
system. Yes.
In the case of black holes, the feature is missing. So
yep, absolutely. Yep. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a moot point. I mean, you can either accept my definition of extensive or look for a different one. But it's, I'm not trying to be flippant. It's an important point. You cannot take a black hole, break it into two pieces, both of which are the same temperature, right?
Yeah.
You can't do it. So how important, and in many formulations, of that is an axiom. That, I mean, the zeroth law in ordinary thermodynamics is an axiom that you can do that.
No, but also that's the physical meaning of this notion of extensiveness.
Yeah, yeah.
And the distinction between intensity and extensiveness.
Yes.
Now, in the case of black holes, seems like this physical distinction is missing. So what is your motivation, maybe?
Well, I suppose the definition of extensive in ordinary thermodynamics depends on a dimension of space. Here I'm saying that when a thermodynamic variable depends on the dimension of space-time, I'm going to call it extensive. Mm-hmm. If you don't like that use of the word extensive, maybe I should use a different word. But you need some criterion for breaking your capital X's and little X's up into two families. And that's the one I'm going to use.
But I mean, there is a physical way to think about it in the context of the membrane paradigm. That, I mean, if you think that you have a hot membrane that sits there, then and there is a local there is an entropy per unit area. So that's an extensive quantity. The entropy is proportional to the area, right?
Yes.
And
yeah.
The question is then, can you define all the other parameters just in that sense, that per unit?
Yeah, but if you do that, well, you could. But if you do that, see, temperature has dimension minus one, so you can write temperature as a power of entropy in terms of dimensions.
Right.
It's just the power will depend on the dimension of space time. You can't do that in ordinary thermodynamics. You cannot write temperature as a power of volume in ordinary thermodynamics.
No, but that's the choice of dimension. I mean, temperature always has dimension minus.
Not in ordinary thermodynamics. In ordinary thermodynamics, the definition of extensive in ordinary thermodynamics, temperature does not scale at all. It does not depend on the volume.
Right, okay, so it's just the way you scale things.
Yeah.
So I can just add a one to everything here, and then suggest a
different. Well, but then pressure would still have dimensions if you added one. I mean.
Yeah. Okay. So, that could
be, so pressure would not be intensive.
So
but that would
be, that's the difference, is that temperature and pressure.
Would and electric potential is zero. So if you add one to that, you get plus one. I mean, okay, so remember our intensive variables are the derivative of internal energy with respect to capital X. And remember the little d's from the previous slide. If I'm going to define a linear combination of the extensive variables that I call capital D here, this is related to scaling, so in some sense d is, I hesitate to use the word dilation, but anyway. The SMA relation can be written like this, that the internal energy is a linear combination of a linear product of the intensive times extensive variables. If we differentiate this with respect to capital XA and contract with DA, you can prove this relation here. Where UAB here is the Hessian of the internal energy. Now remember, for local thermodynamic stability, the Hessian of the internal energy should be positive, and notice this minus sign here. For local thermodynamic stability, the capital U cannot have a negative direction. So for local thermodynamic stability, this quantity must be positive, and that's only possible if pressure times volume is positive. I'm assuming that angular momentum has the same sign as angular velocity. That's equivalent to the assumption that the moment of inertia tensor is positive.
Sorry, what is
positive? Moment of inertia tensor. But if the moment of inertia tensor develops a negative eigenvalue, things are unstable anyway, so under perturbations of angular momentum. So a necessary condition for complete local thermodynamic stability, that is, if we allow all of the extensive variables to vary, a necessary condition is that the pressure times volume must be greater than this combination of entropy and angular momentum. We can determine necessary and sufficient conditions. They all work out to be very natural, so I'll just run through them. First of all, for local thermodynamic stability, we want the specific heat to be positive. Now, I'm going to use specific heat at constant angular velocity. The isentropic moment of inertia tensor must be a positive matrix. And the adiabatic compressibility must be positive. These conditions here give complete necessary and sufficient conditions for thermodynamic stability. That doesn't mean, of course, I mean, if you have the, when I was discussing van der Waals equation earlier, I drew the PV diagram at constant J. If you fix J, you can have stability. Right? When you put a black hole into anti-Sitter space, you can make it stable if the cosmological constant is large enough. Hawking and Page knew that. And if you make it rotate, there are regions of parameter space where it is stable. This heat capacity is positive. So if you fix J, you can make it positive. But if you allow J to fluctuate, then it doesn't have to be, then it might be unstable. So whether or not the situation is stable depends on what parameters you fix. This is standard in thermodynamics. I'm saying if you allow everything to vary, so if you take the complete Legendre transform, so you go from the microcanonical to the canonical to the grand canonical to the super grand canonical ensemble, then these are the conditions that are necessary for stability. And in fact, you can show, certainly for a large class of solutions, for the asymptotically de Sitter Myers-Perry solutions, the adiabatic compressibility is positive. So then, and these are the conditions. In fact, people don't usually mention the moment of inertia tensor either. This is heat capacity is the one that people usually focus on, but I think the moment of inertia tensor is important. Because very often, there are regions of parameter space where the moment of inertia tensor develops negative eigenvalues. And this is related to super rotation of higher dimensional black holes. The angular momentum can go to infinity for higher dimensional black holes. But actually, when the angular velocity is still positive when that happens. It's still finite. It could be either sign, but sorry, it's still finite. Because the infinite angular momentum related to super rotation is actually associated with a singularity in the moment of inertia tensor. Okay, I said I would get round to asymptotically de Sitter, so this is my last slide. People have been asking about asymptotically de Sitter, so David Robb and I wrote a paper on this last year. So let's, if we consider negative pressure, one way of doing this, essentially everything I'm about to say, regardless of the physical motivation, mathematically everything I'm about to say follows just by analytically continuing the anti-de Sitter results to negative pressure. You could argue about the definition of mass in de Sitter space and all that kind of stuff, but everything I'm saying is just mathematically it's a consequence of analytically continuing pressure. Well, the first problem, as I mentioned, is that there are two event horizons, the cosmological one and the black hole event horizon. And there are two different temperatures. And in general, they're not equal. However, if you work out if you fix the mass, then obviously the mass has to be the same. So if the pressure and the angular momentum are the same, what this is saying is that there are two entropies, both of which give the same mass. Right. If you work out the derivative of the mass with respect to the pressure and evaluate the black hole entropy, you get the black hole volume. But there's also a cosmological volume obtained by differentiating the enthalpy with respect to the pressure and setting the pressure equal to the cosmological entropy. And these are not the same in general. So you have two volumes. You have a black hole volume and a cosmological volume. I've written out here what they are for rotating black holes. The simplest way of writing it is to take the black hole radius and the black hole area, multiply the two together and divide by three. So this would be, if the area of the black hole was just pi r squared, then this would be the naive, 4 pi r squared, then this would be the naive geometric volume, the naive Euclidean volume. And one of the things we proved in that paper was that if you fix the cosmological volume, the cosmological horizon is maximized by Schwarzschild sort of space-time where the angular momentum vanishes. The volume between the two horizons, although neither of these is a geometric volume, the volume between the two horizons does look very like what you would think of the geometric volume between the black hole and the cosmological horizon. So the difference between the thermodynamic volumes here does look rather like a geometric volume. And another thing is that if you fix the total entropy, so the sum of the black hole horizon and the cosmological horizon entropies, if you fix that, then it's actually minimized when there's no black hole present. So it's minimized when SBH is zero. So introducing a black hole tends to increase the entropy. Very reasonable result. Okay, there's lots of other things I could talk about, but that's 5:02 now, so my time is up. So let me just summarize and conclude. The suggestion is that when the cosmological constant is non-zero, then there should be a PdV term in the first law for black hole thermodynamics. And when that happens, then the black hole mass should be identified with enthalpy. The thermodynamic volume we define as being the derivative of the enthalpy with respect to pressure. Positive pressure is a necessary condition for complete local thermodynamic stability, assuming the volume is positive. And certainly in all the solutions that we've looked at, all of the IELTS, the asymptotically anti de Sitter Myers Perry metrics, the volume's always positive if you work it out. That's not a theorem, it's just a consequence of looking at a number of solutions. So I haven't checked it for every possible solution. And certainly for the Myers Perry solutions, it's true. So the first law should be modified with the PdV term. And I didn't actually mention this. I thought I'd had this in transparency somewhere, but I didn't mention it. The presence of the PdV term can actually affect the efficiency of a Penrose process. If you look in classic textbooks in general relativity, it'll say the maximal efficiency of a Penrose process is for a charged black hole, and the maximal efficiency you can get is 50%. When you include the cosmological constant, this PdV term can increase the efficiency. And in asymptotically anti de Sitter space time, the maximum efficiency for a Penrose process is 75%. So we don't live in anti de Sitter space, but in principle, the presence of this PdV term can affect the efficiency of a Penrose process. I've described the equation of state at constant angular momentum in various situations. There are critical points with van der Waals type equations of state with mean field exponents. There can be triple points, reentrant phase transitions, and first order phase transitions with the Clapeyrian equation satisfied. So all of your intuition for gases actually carries through. And the compressibility is an important issue. Negative compressibility would be an instability of the black hole. But you can check that in specific cases, and certainly for all Myers-Perry solutions, asymptotically de Sitter rotating black holes in any dimension, the compressibility. It's the variation of volume with respect to pressure. The variation of the volume with respect to pressure. Normally, you know, if you increase the pressure, the volume should go down. Otherwise, it's unstable. So that's positivity of compressibility. Okay, so I think that's it. Yeah. That's it. Thank you. Thanks, Anish.
Good.
So, that's the thing that surprised me for De Sitter. You said that the presence of a black hole in De Sitter minimizes the entropy, doesn't maximize it. I would have expected the opposite.
The absence of that black hole.
No, I think I said the opposite, didn't I?
That's the last.
The entropy is minimized if there is no black hole. So if you introduce a black hole, the entropy goes up.
I guess we discussed this a bit earlier, but I just want to raise it up again. I mean, do you have any sort of good intuition of why we're getting mean field in CRISPR exponents and not, say, Woods and Fisher exponents?
Why did you have
a more like a real rate fluctuation?
Easing model. Fluctuations can change the mean field exponent. My intuition on that is that all of this stuff is classical GR. The Hawking temperature is a result of quantum matter, but it's really classical GR. So my guess is that those mean field exponents are usually associated with classical physics. So my guess would be that the exponents are mean field because it's classical GR. And if you could introduce some quantum gravity effect into the system, the equation state would change, and I would guess the mean field, the exponents would go away from mean field. But that requires making some assumption about microscopic physics and some assumption about your quantum theory of gravity.
Just one comment that I told you about this before. Shandera and me and Piazza also, we had a paper which we showed that for quasi De Sitter situation, because for De Sitter alone without black hole, you cannot write down the first law as the change of energy. It's not very clear what it is. But in that case, also, when we could drive the first law of thermodynamics, the description of thermodynamical laws, if we also included PDV terms. So without that,
okay.
Included that, then we could write down.
Right, okay. I should check out. Yeah, thanks.
So, if I may ask a question then. So, when you did this extensive versus non-extensive variable, so what you could have done basically is just take the first law and multiply everything with some power of Franklin, for example. Right? So, that changes the dimension of all the quantities.
Well, yeah, but you have to, if you use both Newton's constant and Planck's constant, you can make everything dimensions.
Right, but no, I don't want to.
You're kind of throwing the baby out with the bathwater if you do that.
I don't want to make things dimensionless. I'm saying there are different ways of giving dimensions to these quantities.
Yes.
And I mean, you can multiply. So you're starting from the first law, and you can multiply everything by some power of L time, and that changes the dimension. That doesn't change the equation, but that changes the dimension of the variables you're dealing with.
Yeah, but it's not, you can't just do anything you want. Let me try and find the slide. the SMAR relation. Full screen mode, yeah. Let me go and do the SMAR relation in a little more detail. This is relation in four dimensions under this rescaling. So H here is the mass. This is a SMAR relation. This is obtained by not using Planck's constant, just by using Newton's constant to determine the dimensions. This equation is correct for all solutions of Einstein's equations.
Right.
This equation is correct. You can't just introduce an arbitrary scaling here. If you put arbitrary numbers in here, you would get an answer here that just isn't correct. So the Legendre transform is constraining how these variables are allowed to scale. You have to check your scaling against. You're going to end up.
Coefficients care about the dimensions.
Yes.
Yeah.
And in fact, Castoray and Trashin introduced this PDV term precisely because if you missed it out, this is wrong. The SMAR relation does not work if you miss the P term out.
Right, but my point is that you could multiply this by some power of LP, Planck length, for example. And then, of course, all of the terms there would have the same power, but I can multiply P and V with some other power. Mm-hmm. So as long as VPV has the same power of a prime as all the other ones. So I'm saying that
no, that wouldn't work, actually. If you multiply, if you kept the product of PV to have the same power, but made P and V different powers, when you differentiate the entropy with respect to the pressure, you would get a different volume. And it wouldn't, I don't think that would work.
You'd get a different volume.
It's not just scaling. It's scaling plus the Legendre transform. Okay. It's not trivial scaling. You have to check the Legendre transform works.
I guess my concern is that this, the definition of extensive is not unique.
So I agree it's not unique. Yeah. And as I said, you know, there is a debate as to what extensive means in general relativity. I have used a specific working hypothesis.
Okay.
That if the, when you only use Newton's constant to determine the dimensions, if the parameter depends on the dimension of space-time, then I'm calling it extensive. But there may be other possibilities that may be better.
Thank you. Yes.
I have a question about the third law. You said that the parameter
Well, not that I expect it to be non-degenerate. It's an observation that there exists solutions of Einstein's equations where you have zero surface gravity and enormous entropy. That's an observation. It's not a theorem or...
No, but I guess there is a if you have degeneracies, there must be symmetry associated with them, right?
Yeah, and yeah. Normally one, I mean, Nernst wasn't an idiot. When Nernst says that the ground state should be unique, and he was actually thinking of crystals.
Yeah.
And he knew that if the ground state, if your model gives you a degenerate ground state, perturbations tend to lift that degeneracy. That's the fact of life. And so he expected the ground state to be non-degenerate. But there's no theorem saying the ground state has to be non-degenerate. If your theory has a very powerful symmetry, you can have a degenerate ground state. It happens in the quantum Hall effect, for example. In the fractional quantum Hall effect, the ground state's degenerate. It can happen.
Is that exactly degenerate, or is it then as an approximation? It's
my understanding is it's exact. Well, in the non-abelian quantum Hall effect, you have a UN symmetry if the ground state is n-fold degenerate. That's where the non-abelian symmetry comes from. So there are putative models where the ground state is degenerate.
I guess they're exact symmetries that are not broken. Right?
Yeah, but then you have to argue, what's the physics that makes it exact?
Okay. Brian is going to be here for the next couple of months. Your office is 461.